Brothers and sisters and young people, the subject which we have chosen, brothers and sisters, young people, for this weekend is a timely one. It is a timely one not only for the brothers and sisters in this area, it is a timely one for the brothers and sisters from whence I have come. It is a timely study, brothers and sisters, for the Christadelphian community around the world. So timely that the editor of the Christadelphian magazine spent some 3 years, not so long ago, expounding both the first and the second epistles to Timothy, with a very specific purpose in mind, knowing what he does about our community, perhaps better than most of us, that first and second Timothy were very apropos in these days for the Christadelphian community. During that series, Brother Nichols wrote concerning the appropriateness of this study for Christadelphians today. In this second half, he wrote, of the 20th century, we are in a similar position to those in the second half of the first century. They, like us, had lost some of the single-minded enthusiasm kindled by the need to contend for the faith against which They, like us, had lost some of the single-minded enthusiasm kindled by the need to contend for the faith against that which was without, the dangers and the questionings from within. The remedy for our disease is surely to be found in theirs. And amongst the 30 or more people mentioned, the 30 or more people mentioned by name in the 13 short chapters of the Pastorals, a panorama of Judgment Day, since they either helped or hindered, did much evil or refreshed the saints, spoke wholesome or cankerous words, loved this present world, or were not ashamed of the apostles' chain, there were those who resembled ourselves. Which shall we take for our personal examples? Brother Nichols saw that within the pages of these epistles, there were characteristic development in the ecclesias that obviously are parallel to the conditions we find ourselves in. And knowing what he does know from the editor's office, I'm sure he has seen some of those definite needs in our community, perhaps more than some of us who are perhaps only related to one ecclesia or one small ecclesial area. The perspective is a wise one, brothers and sisters, to open our Bibles to a section like this in Scripture and to ask ourselves, what is the pertinent exhortation to young people in this generation, to older people in this generation? What does Paul's message have to do with our problems in our context? And as Alfred has mentioned, in those days, there were people that spoke cankerous words. There were those people that contributed to disease and corruption within the body. There were, however, people like Timothy, Titus, Onesiphorus, people such as Paul himself, who contributed to the health and the strength of the community. In those days, there were people that were faithful to the truth. In those days, there were people who were not so faithful. In those days, there were also people like Hymenaeus and Alexander mentioned in these epistles who had made shipwreck of the faith or of their faith. There were young Timothys that needed to be nurtured and encouraged. There were few Pauls that were willing, ready, and prepared to nurture the future generations of the truth. There were people like Timothy, young and unexperienced in some ways, who nevertheless had a zeal for the truth according to godliness and were willing to guard the precious deposit of the heritage of the truth. There were people like Demas mentioned in these epistles who, Paul says, has loved this present world more than he had loved the truth, who had forsaken his first love and had deceased, spiritually speaking, for a time. The exhortations are relevant because throughout these epistles, there is exhortation for the ecclesia. There's exhortation for the sisters, for the brethren, for the young people, for the older brethren and the younger brethren. for the older sisters and the younger sisters, for the whole body of Christ. And being one of Paul's last pieces of writing, there is a definite tone in these epistles that is somewhat unmatched in the other epistles by the apostle. In your notes, we've made some mention of the circumstances, the time and place of writing. I'm not going to labor this a great deal. We refer to the first page in our notes where we have summarized some of the information that can be gleaned within and without the epistle as to time and place of writing. What is important for our purposes this weekend is to at least grasp this much of the background, and the rest perhaps you can survey at your leisure in the notes. First, the second epistle is not difficult to date at all. It's obvious from the very last chapter of 2 Timothy, and I would say it's unanimously agreed upon by Christadelphian and non-Christadelphian expositors alike, that the second epistle was certainly the last letter Paul ever wrote. It was written under duress. Paul was in custody. He was within the last hours of his life. He speaks in chapter 4 of the second epistle that his course is finished. He is ready to die. And it was only within a matter of months, it would seem, from what we have in outside information, that he was executed. Beheaded, we understand, on the Ostian Way, not too far outside of the city of Jerusalem, under the orders of Nero Caesar. So when Paul wrote the second epistle, it was within the last hours. The first epistle is not as easy to date, and we've mentioned this in the notes. Won't go into the details, which suggest, I think, strongly, that the first epistle was written very close in time to that of the second epistle, perhaps only about 2 years between them. Some have suggested the first epistle was written much earlier than that, but I believe that the weight of evidence is against that. There are some remarkable characteristics about 1 and 2 Timothy, usage of certain phrases and words which are not found elsewhere in Paul's epistles. In fact, as we've mentioned in the notes here, there are between 146 and 188 words in these two letters that occur nowhere else in the New Testament. That is easily understood if these two epistles were companion letters, written only within a few years apart, written in very similar circumstances to the same man from probably the same place to the same place. The unity of unique phrases and words between these two epistles is not so easily explainable if, in fact, they're written at two ends of Paul's ministry, one at the very early part and one at the end. We wouldn't expect to see some of the unique phrases occurring as they do between those two epistles. Now let's capture the tone, brothers and sisters and young people. Here are two letters written both within the last 3 or 4 years of the Apostle Paul's life. The very last words that he wrote that the Spirit decided to preserve on record for us. Urgent words, surely. The words of an older man in the faith. Paul had run his course. The shadows were creeping across the path. He knew that the executor wasn't too far away. And he hints very clearly at that in the second epistle. Last words are usually emotional words. They are often terse. They're brief, pointed, and they're packed with meaning. When someone is giving their last words, they don't tend to waste words. And what they say at the last, in the last hour, is often worth listening to very, very closely. And within these two epistles, Paul has jam-packed many, many thoughts and exhortations in some very few words. There are no words wasted, to say the least. He has used a tone that is both somewhat emotional. He refers to tears. He refers to his own. He refers to Timothy's. There's a sense of urgency, as we've said. There's a sense of authoritative command. An older man is speaking to a younger man in the truth. Most importantly, and what makes it a most delightful study, is 1 and 2 Timothy are packed with very graphic, concrete illustrations. Paul has used many concrete illustrations in these two epistles to convey the Spirit's message through its inspiration. The Spirit has so worked on Paul's mind, drawing from his own personal experiences, and of course, the rich background of the Old Testament scriptures, to convey these last messages in very, very graphic terms. And we're going to look at how graphic those terms are. They make the message easy to understand, and they help us to latch on to the exhortation. We're going to take a thematic approach. Rather than going verse by verse or chapter by chapter, we're going to go right through both epistles, time and again, scanning through various chapters and bridging the two epistles in order to develop certain themes that are predominant. And that's why, brothers and sisters, we've furnished you with these little notes. It is possible, looking at the third page, for example, to approach a study like 1st and 2nd Timothy in a sequential way, chapter by chapter. But if you notice carefully in these epistles, after having read them this weekend, there isn't really a chronological development or a sequential development in these epistles, as there is, for example, in some of the smaller epistles by the Apostle Paul, where there's a definite climax that reaches some point in the epistle, such as in Philippians or Ephesians. It's possible, therefore, without wrenching things out of context, to look at these epistles by considering the key terms and words. Now, what we've done for you in these notes is, in a rather sketchy way, list some of the key words or terms that are used repetitively by the Apostle Paul, many of which are unique to this epistle and to Titus. When you do that by using a concordance or a lexicon, it helps you to come to a very objective conclusion about what the Spirit is intending us to notice as a predominant theme. For example, on page 3, we've listed for you a theme which we'll be talking about shortly. True doctrine, viewed in the epistle as a precious deposit that is to be jealously guarded and preserved. Now, how do we know that's a theme or a predominant emphasis in these epistles? Well, as you let your eye scan down from numbers 1 to 6 on the chart on page 3, you'll see how many Greek words, and we've given them for you, are used with very similar shades of meaning to emphasize and re-emphasize this one predominant theme that we've listed for you. True deposit of the doctrine, to be jealously guarded. We've noted almost every place where those words occur in the first and second epistle of Timothy. And by looking over to the occurrences, you can see how frequently these terms are used and how they together make a predominant theme. We're going to concern ourselves with page 4, somewhat, in our first class. It's entitled, Wholesome Words. Notice what page 4 helps to show us. There is a medical theme running through 1st and 2nd Timothy that provides a very graphic exhortation for believers in the 20th century, as it did for young Timothy in Ephesus. First, a word used in the English AV that comes out often translated as whole or sound, used frequently in these two epistles. The Greek word, you may not recognize it as it's spelt there, hygiano, is the word from which we get the word hygiene. In Greek, the U often is replaced in English by a Y. It is the Greek word hygiene. It's the word from which hygiene in English is built. Paul has a lot to say about hygiene in this epistle. It's part of a larger theme, a medical theme. He uses the word sound quite frequently. Sound. Several Greek words being used in several places through the epistles, and it has the idea of being sober. Sober not so much in the sense of the opposite of being drunk, but in the sense of having a right state of mind. For example, it's the word used to describe legion in the Gospels. When the Master had restored him, in the Gospels it says, that he was in his right mind in Luke's gospel. You see, it was associated very strongly by Luke, a physician, by the way, with a man who had been deranged. Whether he had epilepsy or some form of mental degeneracy, we don't know. But when Legion was healed, it is said that he had sophronismos. He had a right state of mind, previously deranged, but now stabilized by the Master's touch. And it's exactly the same word that is repeatedly used in these epistles to Timothy. Something he is to strive for, a right state of mind, a sober, well-adjusted, well-balanced, well-adjusted in the spiritual sense. He uses positively the word nourish in 1 Timothy 4 and 6. Again, a word related to good health. A body, both spiritually and physically, needs to be nourished consistently. A well-balanced diet, a steady diet, a consistent diet in the right things. We'll come back to this in a few moments. Over to the far right, under occurrence, we've noted that he uses the word gymnazo. Perhaps you'll recognize it. He uses the very word from which we make the word gymnasium or gymnastics or gymnast. He uses it in 1 Timothy 4 and 7. It's a Greek word borrowed by the Romans. Initially, the word gymnazo meant to be naked. It meant to be stripped absolutely naked, to describe the Olympian runners who ran naked in those days. It was the word to describe the young men in training for the great Olympian or the Isthmian Games that were held throughout areas in Macedonia. Those who were training were gymnasts. They were individuals who were completely stripped of all their clothing and preparing their bodies and their minds for the enduring race. Paul uses that word to Timothy. Negatively, look at how many terms have a medical connotation. He uses that infrequent word, word that we're not used to using much anymore, the word doting. It's the Greek word nosseo, as we've listed for you, and it means to be diseased. Significantly, it's used by Luke. Remember, he was a physician. In Luke 4 and 40, it comes out as the word disease in English. Paul talks about something that is cankerous in these epistles. And again, you might identify the Greek word. It is the word gangrene, to gnaw, to eat, to deteriorate through some kind of a living organism. He uses another word, to eat. It's the Greek word nome, which means to feed or spread. And Bullinger tells us it's used especially amongst the Greek writers to describe the spread of ulcers. The word corrupt is used several times in these epistles to Timothy. And the Greek word means physical decay. He uses the word to pierce through, speaking of those who have pierced themselves through with their deadly doctrines. It means a deadly, lethal wound. It means to be pierced right through, like a sword wound or a knife wound or a spear wound. He uses the word turn aside, which may not suggest much medically to us. But Vines and Bullinger both tell us, it too is a medical term. It meant originally to be turned or twisted, to be dislocated or to be out of joint. And if you were to take a look in Hebrews 12 in the King James in verse 13, it's translated as the word lame. And if you looked at your margin, you would clearly see that the other rendition is also medical. Interestingly, in Titus's epistle, we've listed this for you on the right-hand side under occurrence. In Titus's epistle, the opposite of this word is used. It's not used in Timothy, but it is in the sister epistle in Titus. The Greek word epidothoro meant to set straight, to relocate, to set again, as a bone is reset in order for it to be healed. Paul uses the word hurtful in 1 Timothy 6. It meant to be noxious, a medical term describing something that was weakening or disabling. And finally, he uses the word sorrow once, and it means pain of mind or body. Now, brothers and sisters, when we're alerted to the frequency of so many terms related to a medical theme, We have right before us a predominant idea in 1 and 2 Timothy, which we're going to explore in this class. Why use so many unique terms? Why such a theme? How is it pertinent to Timothy's condition ecclesially? And what's the exhortation to us? Well, again, what we've done then is by listing those things in the notes, we've justified the fact that there is such a theme, we hope, in these 1 and 2 epistles. You perhaps can see a little more objectively where the theme has come from and how it is built by the construction of such words and the frequency of those terms. Let's just consider an answer to why. Why such a theme? We're going to leave the notes temporarily, and you perhaps will want to refer to them if you keep that page open. First, let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 23 and use this as a starting point. First Timothy chapter 5, verse 23. Paul writes to Timothy along a personal vein. Drink no longer wine, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine oft infirmities. Thine oft infirmities. Timothy was personally afflicted by some kind of disabling physical weakness, a stomach problem of some sort. It was acute enough for Paul to draw attention to it, and acute enough, important enough, for Paul, in such an urgent letter, as part of the last lines that he was to write to Timothy, to include such personal information and such a personal exhortation. Timothy, then, would be certainly, from a human point of view, one who understood what physical infirmities were. He had them himself. And what about Paul? Paul writes to the Corinthians and admits to his accusers that his bodily presence was weak, that his speech, indeed, was contemptible. He was not an eloquent speaker, although we may have the opposite impression in our mind. He admits that his accusers had a fair point. And his bodily presence wasn't the greatest. He wasn't some great, strapping, robust man. He didn't have some kind of domineering impression when he came amongst people physically. So Paul himself, of course, wasn't the picture of health and strength. Also in the second epistle to the Corinthians, he talks about a thorn in his flesh, which is most likely a physical one. He prays three times that he might be relieved of this thorn in the flesh. He too experienced physical infirmities and weakness. So Timothy would certainly be attuned personally to a medical type of theme. He would certainly know this from having worked with Paul, that Paul too had personal physical infirmities. But really, such little clues in these epistles don't really provide the real answer as to why. Because Timothy and I'm sure Paul had many personal circumstances the Spirit never chose to select. There are many things that must have happened in Paul's life, personally, and Timothy's, that never enter into the epistles. Whatever enters into the epistles must have been selected by the Spirit in particular. It must have served a specific purpose as far as the Spirit designed. It is the Spirit that is selecting these circumstances, and it is the Spirit, no doubt, that is guiding Paul to stress this medical theme, positive aspects and negative aspects. The question, why? How are we to answer that? We still really haven't reached the bottom of that. Look at Acts chapter 20. Now, why are we going to Acts? Because Acts chapter 20 describes the foundation of the Ephesian ecclesia. And it is in Ephesus that Timothy is working. There are clues in both the first and second epistle that Ephesus is Timothy's ecclesia. Now, in Acts chapter 20, we have circumstances surrounding the formation of the Ephesian ecclesia. And in Acts 20, we're told that verse 17, Paul was met on this journey by a contingent of elders from the ecclesia at Ephesus. Verse 17. Paul spoke to these individuals on the beach. And what did he tell them? Verse 28, to the Ephesian elders, to the arranging board. Take heed, he tells them, therefore, unto yourselves, and to all the flock over which the Holy Spirit hath made you overseers, to feed the ecclesia of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood. For, Paul says, I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Also, of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them. Therefore, watch, and remember that by the space of 3 years I cease not to warn every one of you, every one, night and day with tears. And now, brethren, I commend you to God, and to the word of his grace, which is able to build you up, and to give you an inheritance among all them that are sanctified. There are a number of terms used here to describe Paul's message to the Ephesian elders, which are repeated in 1 and 2 Timothy. We would do well to look carefully at these terms and keep our eye on 1 and 2 Timothy. A number of terms, as we've said, especially in the second epistle, I would say, are drawn from the message that he gives here to the Ephesian elders. What's important for our purposes here with a medical theme is that Paul had warned the arranging board at Ephesus that they would very shortly be threatened by internal divisive influences. Men not from the world, not the Judaizers, which often plagued the first century apostle, but men of their own selves, like wolves in sheep's clothing, would arise and would draw away innocents in the flock. See, there was the warning to the Ephesian arranging board. Now, some years later, he writes these epistles to 1 and 2 Timothy, and he speaks of cankerous influences in the ecclesia. He spells out the names of specific brethren, such as Hymenaeus and Alexander, who he says have made shipwreck of the faith. He talks about gangrene setting into the body of Christ, gnawing and eating away at the vitals. He speaks of disease themes running through the ecclesia. He uses terms that were descriptive of the defiling issues under the law of Moses as they were covered in Leviticus. He warns Timothy in the same way that he warned the arranging board here on the beach, not far from Ephesus, that there would be influences in the ecclesia that need to be guarded against. He is speaking of internal rot within the body of Christ. And he warns Timothy, as he warned the arranging board years before, to guard against it. He talks about how to diagnose it. He talks about how to perhaps even prevent it. He talks about what the antidote really is in order to combat the problem. He uses graphic terms related to the law of Moses with the unclean issues and so on, but he uses practical terms known to Romans and Greeks as well. It's interesting, brothers and sisters, that this truly is the reason why the Spirit selected such a theme. Not so much the fact that Paul knew what physical infirmities were, oh, that would make it even more graphic. Not just the fact that Timothy personally had known what afflictions meant, that he had some kind of chronic illness himself. But rather, the Spirit sees that here there needs to be a further development of what Paul had warned the elders of Ephesus years before. And in warning Timothy, he warns the ecclesia, beware of the growth of internal disease. Here's how to diagnose it, and here's what to do about it. And there's where it's appropriate for us. As Brother Nichols has said, many years have passed since we had our pioneer brethren with all the vigor and the enthusiasm of pioneers. We have become a more settled generation of Christadelphians. I think we can speak fairly for all of us. Our own circumstances in life are far more settled and far more comfortable than they were at the time of Brother Thomas or Brother Roberts. And you know, that's what's happened in these epistles to Timothy. Paul had given these early warnings when he settled the Ephesian ecclesia on one of his journeys. Years have passed, not as many years that have passed behind us from our pioneer brethren, but years have passed. The Ephesian ecclesia has reached a greater age. More problems have arisen. They're probably more settled in certain ways. And certain problems, typical to an older ecclesia, have begun to settle in. Once again, we see the parallel circumstances and the appropriateness to ourselves. Well, brothers and sisters, let's just notice how this particular theme is developed. We've said there are various negatives. If you again look at your chart on page 4, we have put two subtitles. The positive, first, numbers 1 to 3. The use of the word whole, sound, and the positive exhortation to be nourished. And then there are a number of medical terms related to the negative. And they go from numbers 4 to 11. I want just to look at this carefully. What is the root cause of spiritual gangrene mentioned in number 5? What's the root cause of disease, nosail? What is it in the body of Christ that can contribute to deadly wounds, brethren being pierced through, as it were? What causes within the body of Christ as an ecclesia, as a community, or as individuals, brethren and sisters, to be dislocated, to be fractured, to be out of joint, as it were, spiritually speaking, and therefore the need to be reset, as he uses the other term in Titus? What causes the ecclesia to become noxious in its atmosphere and its environment? What causes pain and affliction in ecclesial membership or in a community's membership or in the life of an individual? All of those terms can be applied to a community, to a single ecclesia, and to all of us individually. What's the cause? Well, let Timothy answer this, that is the epistles. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 2. Here's a remarkable development of this theme, and we wouldn't be alert to it by just looking at the English. 1 Timothy 4, verse 1 and 2. Notice how the disease is described and how it comes in. 1 Timothy 4, verse 1. Paul says, "Now the Spirit speaketh expressly, that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils." Verse 2. "Speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron," and then he describes some of their perspectives, "forbidding to marry," and so on. I want to look at verse 2 carefully. Speaking lies in the original language, in the Greek, is all one word. It is the word pseudo, from which we get the word pseudo, meaning false, pseudo logos, from which we get the word, well, the Logos magazine, for example, we mention the word logos in John 1. It's the Greek word for word. Pseudo logos, false words. There's one of the contributing factors, brothers and sisters, in any community, to spiritual rot. There would be brethren, as Paul told the elders in Ephesus in Acts 20, of their own selves, that we've got to see clearly, who would speak lies or would speak pseudo-logos, false words. Now we might say, well, surely brothers and sisters would never speak false words. Yes, they will, brothers and sisters. And the sooner we admit that to ourselves, the more likely we are to be candid and to be accurate in taking a look at our own ecclesial environment. Not blatant lies, not telling a brother, for example, that he went shopping yesterday and didn't, but look at the context of verse 1 and 2, 3 and 4, and so on. This is speaking to the household. This is not speaking about apostate Christendom. Paul told them that of their own selves men would arise. This is an ecclesial picture. It's the community. It's from within that the rot is being described. And one of the causes would be pseudo-logos, false words, such as in verse 3, making certain commandments and restrictions that are not truly based on scriptural injunctions, forbidding to marry, commanding some that they should abstain from certain things, where God has said in verse 4 instead that every creature is good and to be received. Do we have those problems today in the ecclesia? Well, only you can answer them. But there are tendencies within our community at times when false words are indeed spoken. Not perhaps in a blatant sense. Not in the sense of somebody deliberately trying to tell a lie, but somebody who's misinformed. Somebody who is speaking about something they ought not to speak about. Speaking about something they think they know something about and don't. Perhaps puffed up. Perhaps verse 2, having got to the point where their conscience is seared with a hot iron. That means to be cauterized. The language that is used, for example, when farmers lance off the horns of a bull or a cow, and they have to cauterize the horn immediately. Now, some of those who have got farming background in their own personal lives will know what we're referring to. When a horn from a bull is lanced, it has to be usually touched with a hot iron. They have various little gadgets which they use to cauterize it immediately. It's painful, but it seals off the break immediately. Now, that's the kind of picture, graphically, that Paul is talking about. Did it happen in Israel's history? We know more, perhaps, about Israel's history as an ecclesia than we do, perhaps, about some of the details in the first century. In Israel's times, we know that time and time again, the ecclesia of Israel hardened their hearts. Moses warned about it time and again. These 10 times, he told Israel, these 10 times in the wilderness, you have challenged God, you have rebelled. And he described them as stubborn, hard-hearted, stiff-necked. Their consciences had been seared with a hot iron. It's possible, brothers and sisters, ever so slowly, to allow that kind of spiritual disease to set in. Ever so imperceptibly, for those of us who may think that we're not touched by such problems, we should ask ourselves, maybe we are. It is possible, brothers and sisters, without some of these things listed in verse 3, to fabricate rules in an ecclesia that are strictly arbitrary. It is possible to develop a kind of Pharisaical finger-pointing, where certain things are thou shalt not, and certain things are thou shalt, when there's no clear scriptural injunction. It's a matter of conscience. Here we do have a problem in our community at times, brothers and sisters. Issues that are a question of personal conscience becoming legislated laws. We should learn from the example of Israel's history and the exhortations in these epistles. We are saved by grace, not by law-keeping. There are issues that are a matter of conscience. There are issues that are a question of basic principle, and there's a difference between them. False words can eat away at an ecclesia. Brethren and sister, bickering and fighting over certain issues that are not fundamental, that are not of a first principle nature, but they're divisive. Look at this next term that are used. 1 Timothy 6 and 4. Words, words, words. The expressions we're fingering here, looking at carefully, are all terms that have the word logos in them. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 4. Again, the English doesn't alert us to the term. Verse 4, speaking of someone who doesn't receive Paul's exhortation. He is proud, Paul says, knowing nothing, but doting about questions. Doting about questions. And strifes of words, whereof cometh envy, strife. Railings, evil surmisings, perverse disputings of men of corrupt minds, destitute of the truth. Now look how much is packed in these two verses here, brothers and sisters, related to our medical theme. First, the word corrupt in verse 5 is listed in the disease column. It is listed for us as number 7 on page 4. There is a medical term right there. Doting about words. On your page, it's number 4, the Greek word noseo, disease. There are 2 terms that he's used so far. Now we have a context that's appropriate. Here's part of this kind of spiritual disease being described. Here we have, truly, a problem of spiritual rot in the ecclesia. And what's the cause? Well, look at the cause. Verse 4, he is proud, number 1. Knowing nothing, somebody who thinks he knows something, though. Doting about questions, and if you look at your margin, the medical theme is suggested by gallings, one of another. Literally, the RSV says, being diseased about questions. Being diseased about questions, which is the sense of the original. And, now here's the term we want to notice. Strifes of words. Three words in the English, but only 1 word in the Greek. This time, it's the word logos, or logo, machia, M-A-C-H-I-A, logomachia. It means war words. Words of wars, literally. It's all one word. War words. Words that are expressed in a spirit that is factious, warring, unchristlike, unforgiving, unkind, negative. Words that generate disease in the body. Do we have that problem? Yes, we do. Unfortunately, to our own demise, many, many times in our own ecclesias, and I know this to be true in my own area, I'm sure it's true from the words that Brother Nichols has written concerning his own environment in Britain. It's characteristic of a human community, but it ought not for a community that is based on spiritual principles. Do we not at times in our own ecclesias, at times perhaps in a CYC, speaking of the young people, in our own homes between spouses, between the children, the young people in that house, have wars of words? Vapor, meaning nothing, accomplishing nothing, having no substance to build or to improve the strife or the problem, not assisting the tension or reducing the strife. We do have that kind of a problem, and it's the kind of problem Paul zeroes in on. Timothy, he says, in building the ecclesia at Ephesus, stay away from false words. Stay away from war words, words that gender heat and no light, have no warmth or strength or positive cementing value. Stay away from them, he says to Timothy. Don't allow yourself or your fellow brethren and sisters to become ensnared in wars of words. Now, the subject can change from ecclesia to ecclesia, circumstance to circumstance. In a home, brothers and sisters, we all know it's true. I know it's true in my own classroom back at school. When there's a bickering going on that lasts for several days, and young people have that capacity as much as older ones, it affects the whole tone of my classroom. I can see it at recess or in between periods. I can see it in the hall. I can see several of the boys or the girls back and forth at each other. All kinds of cattiness, bickering, whispering, backbiting, and so on. Wars of words on a perfectly natural plane that can eat into and destroy the atmosphere of my own classroom. But it happens at home too, doesn't it? It can happen in the ecclesia. It has happened in the ecclesias right here in New England, and it has back in Brantford, and it has in Toronto. And it did at the time that Paul is writing. It happened in Ephesus. If Paul is exhorting Timothy to avoid this, Paul must have known something about the ecclesia in Ephesus. Causes of spiritual disease. 1 Timothy chapter 1, a third word, which Paul pinpoints as the cause of disease. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 4. Perhaps verse 3 helps for the context. We'll just back up. 1 Timothy 1, verses 3 and 4. He reminds Timothy of a little bit of history. A history shared between themselves in their joint work together when Paul was free. Verse 3 of 1 Timothy chapter 1. As I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus, one of the clues we have in the epistle, by the way, that this is where Timothy's home base is. As I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus, when I went into Macedonia, that thou mightest charge some that they teach no other doctrine. Now, this is interesting. In English, of course, we've got three words, no other doctrine. That's one word in the Greek. And it means, literally in the Greek, to be an other teacher. It's all one word, other teacher. Exhort the brothers and sisters not to be an other teacher. An other teacher. What does that mean? To teach something other than, obviously, what Paul has laid down as the gospel. To be an other teacher. Someone who swerves, diverges from the original gospel, who adds to or subtracts from the original deposit, as Paul describes it in these epistles. Now, that's an interesting phrase. He warns Timothy to warn others not to be an other teacher. Verse 4, neither give heed to fables and endless genealogies which minister questions, and the word means disputes, rather than godly edifying. The word godly edifying is one word in the original, and it means
building a house. Notice the positive principle. Don't give heed to fables and pointless genealogies which furnish or minister disputes or questions, rather than the building of a house, rather than godly building, godly edifying, which is in faith. Notice, brothers and sisters, the need here for a warning against these disease influences. Now verse 6, describing those who have succumbed to these things, from which some, having swerved, and the word means to miss the mark, have turned aside, that word that we've listed on page 4, to turn aside, to be dislocated, unto vain jangling. Now, vain jangling, what's that? It's one word in the original, and it's another one of those words that has logos attached to it. It's the word matia logia, M-A-T-I-A, matia or matia logia. And it means matia logia. It has the idea of strife in it. It has the idea of something that is vain or godless. It clearly describes a wilderness of words translated by the New English Bible, and they've captured the Greek quite well there. A wilderness of words. Matia logia, a wilderness of words. Once again, notice how the apostle, or the Spirit, zeroes in on phrases that are related to our words, to our words. There's the Spirit's wisdom. If we ask ourselves, how does such a disease creep into a community, into an ecclesia, into a home, into our own spiritual lives? The Spirit is saying, it's related to words, brethren. Young people, it's related to our words. Not just what we talk, but words convey a message. It's related to what we're feeding on, to the words we're taking in and the words we're putting out. That's the root cause of spiritual disease. What are we thinking about? What are we dwelling on? What are we saying? What are we talking about? What is our conversation? What are we saying? How are we saying it? What are we tuned into? What words are we feeding on? That will influence the condition, the spiritual condition of the body. So three phrases are used by Paul. Pseudologia, false words. Logomachia, false, not false words, but war words. And this one here in verse 6, matia logia, a wilderness of words. That happens often in ecclesia, brothers and sisters, doesn't it? It happens, brothers and sisters, when we have to look at ourselves and say, what are we saying to each other? How are we saying it? What's being communicated? Is it positive or is it helpful? Now, brothers and sisters, as we progress through these epistles, we'll see time and again how these medical themes are developed. Brothers and sisters, let us take heed to this exhortation to warn ourselves against that which corrupts and decays, and adhere to that which is wholesome, hygienic, spiritually sound doctrine.